Welcome to Unpacking Peanuts, the podcast where three cartoonists take an in-depth look at the greatest comic strip of all time, Peanuts by Charles M. Schulz.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Unpacking Peanuts. We're looking at 1952 in detail today. It's a bit of a to be continued from last time. I'm Jimmy Gownley. If you know me at all, you might know me from my comic book series, Amelia Rules, or my memoir, The Dumbest Idea Ever. My most recent book is called Seven Good Reasons Not to Grow Up, and it's published by Scholastic Books, and I'll be your host for the evening. Joining me, as always, are my pals and co-hosts. We have the composer for the band Complicated People, as well as for this very podcast, and the cartoonist behind Strange Attractors, Tangled River, and A Gathering of Spells. We have Michael Cohen.
Hello there.
Hey, Michael. And from the classic television show Mystery Science Theater 3000, we have executive producer and writer, as well as former vice president of Archie Comics and the creator of the Instagram strip Sweetest Beast, Harold Buchholz.
Hello.
Guys, we're looking at 1952. We've got so caught up in the details and the excitement of the year that we had to make this a to-be-continued episode. So what do you think? You guys want to get right to it today?
Sure.
Yes.
All right, so picking up where we left off. June 22nd, Charlie Brown is walking towards the store entrance. He says, "I'm discouraged today, and when I get discouraged, a comic magazine is the only thing that will revive me." He stands before a beautiful display of comic books from 1952 and says, "What a beautiful, gory layout." In panel three, he is looking through the comics and starts tossing the ones he's not interested in. He says, "This druggist is awfully fussy. He won't let you look at the comic magazines unless you buy one." In panel four, "Gee, the cover came off this one. I hardly jerked it." In panel five, he's attempting to reach the books on the top of the shelf, but is actually causing a bit of an avalanche of the comics beneath and says, "Those on the top row look pretty good." Whoops. Charlie Brown goes flying, comic books everywhere. Charlie Brown sits among the comics on the floor and says, "He should sell these for half price. Who wants a magazine after it's been lying around on the floor?" In the next panel, he walks up to the druggist, who we don't see, and says, "I guess I'll take this one," as he hands over his dime. Charlie Brown walks out of the store looking over his shoulder and says, "Boy, did he ever glare at me. He probably isn't feeling well."
This is my pick of the year. It might be my pick of the decade. This is just so iconic. You do have to put it a little bit in perspective, though, and we won't go too deep into comic book history, but there was a period starting after the war when comic books were not doing superheroes, and they were trying everything, you know, Westerns and romance. And what really caught on around this period, 1952, was horror, to the point where it got so bad that there was actually a congressional committee set up to investigate, you know, juvenile delinquency and comics. So you have to see it when Charlie Brown... Look at the strip. It's really beautiful. When he's looking at the rack of comics, which says "For the Kiddies"
in old English,
the titles are Mangle, Terror, War, Hate, Gouge, Kill, Murder, Stab, Ouch, Another Murder, Choke, Slaughter, Throttle, Crush, Kill, Hit, Kick, Smash, Jab, Run Through, Blast, Killer, War. This is not an exaggeration.
No, it's really not.
And the Comics Code, which came in, 2 years later, basically outlawed. The comics could no longer have any titles that dealt with any kind of violence or bloodshed. So the fact that, you know, For the Kiddies, this is true. The kids were buying this stuff, and they were really horrifying. So anyway, as a longtime comic collector, you know, though not quite this far back, you know, it just sums up the whole experience.
Yeah, when I was working on the Mystery Science Theater 3000, the comic book graphic novel with Joel Hodgson, and we were going back through old Golden Age strips, one of the things we came upon was a comic called Horrific. And so we had Crow T. Robot as the Crow Keeper, which is a parody of the Crypt Keeper, which is this old crone kind of character with saliva dripping from its lips, where Crow is essentially telling these horror stories. And it's a comic from this era. It's probably within a year or so of when this strip came out. And they are quite graphic. You've got severed hands and undead coming up from the past, trying to pull people into the grave. I mean, it is really, really remarkably dark stuff that was in the comics of that day. And it's hilarious that Schultz is bringing that into his little Peanuts world. And that this is something, given all of the titles, Charlie Brown must have chosen one of them, unless his head was blocking the Fuzzy Bunny comic.
I think he's going for Throttle.
Oh, he went for Throttle?
Looks like it. It looks like he's going for it.
Wow. That's the one. That's the one he wanted most. But yeah, and Schultz, he tells stories about, he was quite the comic collector and reader in the 40s when he was growing up. He said he was the local librarian. He had all of the Big Little books, and so kids would know to come to him to get the Big Little books, which were essentially little, you know, 200-400 page, 4x5 inch books, very similar to the comics that usually contained cartoon characters on one side with a panel of an old comic strip, and the other side was written text. But between the Big Little books and the comic books, he claimed he was like the librarian for comics. If kids wanted something, they knew to go to him because he had it all.
As a piece of cartooning, this is beautiful. I am a huge advocate of hand lettering. You know, every chance I get to hand letter my stuff, I do. And he hand letters all the little titles on all those comics.
Jim is a multiple Eisner Award nominee for those listening in here for his lettering, and for good reason. The work he did in Amelia Rules, if you've ever seen his graphic novel series, it's just some amazing, beautiful, creative use of text, which you can do in comics that we often don't take advantage of as much because we like to use computerized fonts and letters. And there's so much creatively you can do with the lettering and the text, but also sound effects and things along those lines.
Well, that's nice of you to say. One thing I would say, you know, if anyone out there is a young person and they're listening to this and thinking about becoming a cartoonist, obviously you're going to have to figure out a digital workflow, because that's just the way the world is now, and it's not going to change in the future. It'll just become more so. However, every chance you get to put your own personality in it, you have to take it. Hand lettering is a big one. Everything you let the computer do for you is one thing that makes you slightly more ordinary. So if you're going to use a font, make sure it's a really, really good font, or make your own font. And if you can, just hand letter it. And what I love about this is that he takes the time and makes sure every one of those titles is in the right place, you know, panel after panel. The other thing, Charlie Brown should have gone for Hate, because Pete Bags Hate is one of the greatest comic books of all time. And I had no idea it dated all the way back to this year. That would have been great. You know, and the other thing I find about this strip, or that I think that struck me about this is one of the earliest strips I would have ever seen. I would have seen strips before this, but chronologically from Schultz creating it, this would have been one of the earliest strips. A lot of those earlier things that we talked about in the previous episodes were never seen by me, certainly, and really weren't reprinted until the Fantagraphics books came out in the 2000s. But this one, this is burned into my brain. I've loved this strip since I was just a little boy. That panel of him flying as all the comics get tossed everywhere, I just love it. It's beautifully drawn.
Yeah, and I'm glad to know this is what Charlie Brown does to clear up his discouragement. Whenever he feels discouraged, he picks up a copy of Throttle.
That's what you got to do. Hey, also, just real quick, talking about the putting your own personality in it by doing it by hand. If you look at that middle panel, when you see a really nicely drawn drugstore behind Charlie Brown, including the counter with the soda fountain and stuff, there's not a ruler to be had there. Those stools look like they could come out of, you know, 1968 Peanuts. I don't know how he did, if he did a lot of underdrawing or if he just kind of went for it, but I love it. It looks really great.
Yeah, that's I hadn't noticed that, but that really is cool. It's just got this living line, even for things that have hard edges and right angles, and it's nice.
Yeah, you see his hand in everything in this strip. June 29th, Patty and Charlie Brown are playing marbles. Patty is doing really well. Charlie Brown says, "Luck, dumb luck, luck," as Patty continues to knock marbles out of the ring. Charlie Brown, "Plain luck, just plain downright old fool luck. Luck, luck, luck." Patty says, "Well, that ends the game, Charlie Brown, unless you've got some more marbles." Charlie Brown drops his empty marble sack. "You know I have them. You just can't beat fool luck." Patty walks away whistling happily. Charlie Brown yells after her, "Luck, luck, luck, luck." Then says to us, "Boy, can that girl ever play marbles."
Schultz was on to something. Because my two picks for the year are a week apart. The Sundays. I think he gets the Sundays up to like genius level before he gets the dailies up to genius level. This is really great. I mean, even if it's kids acting like kids, there's nothing, you know, out of place here of them being intellectual. And we've all done this. So we all understand exactly what's going on here. Probably has a lot to do with the fact that she's a girl and she's beating him. He doesn't really emphasize that. And then he's talking to the reader, which is kind of odd.
They do that throughout all the 50 years of Peanuts. A lot of the punchlines it's never explicitly stated that they're talking directly to the reader, like in Ferris Bueller's Day Off or something, but they turn and look to the camera and deliver a punchline. And I love that. By the way, marbles was a game that children in the last century would play, where they would have these glass round balls that they put in a circle, and you'd have to take your larger glass round ball and try to knock the smaller ones outside the circle. And then if you did, you were able to keep that person's marbles.
I'm sure you can play virtual marbles somewhere.
There probably is an app, iMarbles. July 14th, Charlie Brown and Lucy are outside. Charlie Brown is sitting on a tricycle. Lucy says, "I'll tell you what, Charlie Brown, I've got a baby brother at home. I'll trade you him for your tricycle." Charlie Brown turns his back on Lucy and pedals away saying, "Absolutely not. What good would a baby brother do me?" Lucy says, "I knew you'd say that, and I don't blame you at all. He's no good to me either." Lucy has a brother.
Yeah, so we have a family dynamic going on here. That is the first mention of Linus. So again, just in terms of time, we have a verbal Meredith as his oldest child. And we have a second child in the family, Monty, born February 1st. So let's say this was probably done around June 1st, so maybe 4 months old at the time that Schultz drew this strip. And we have this dynamic now of not only kids in the neighborhood, all single child situations. We now have a family of kids, an older sister and a younger brother. And this is the first time we see that dynamic represented. And it certainly is one that was part of the Schultz household at this time. So it's really kind of fun to see there's this whole other level of siblings that we're getting to see here for the very first time.
August 16th. "How about a game of marbles, Charlie Brown?" says Shermie. Charlie Brown answers, "That would be fine if I could win, but I'd probably lose. Then I'd get depressed." Charlie Brown continues, "Then I'd be real grumpy. I wouldn't talk to anyone, and I'd hate myself. Thanks anyway."
Oh, depression is so funny.
It is. All right, moving on. August 24th, Charlie Brown looks outside his front door. It's gone. Of all the nerve. "Lucy's taken my baseball glove again." He goes off looking for her. "Just because I leave it on the front sidewalk every night, she thinks it's public property. I'm going to settle this once and for all. Hey, you," he shouts as he sees Lucy playing with his glove. Lucy makes a spectacular catch. She makes a second spectacular catch of a ground ball. She snatches a line drive from the air. She snatches a second line drive from her opposite side. Charlie Brown watches it all. Lucy notices it and says, "Oh, do you want your glove back, Charlie Brown?" Charlie Brown walks away saying, "No, you might as well keep it, Lucy. I'll probably never have use for it again."
Great. It's a great strip.
All right. Glad we read that one. Moving on.
Well,
is there anything else anybody has to say about that?
Well, clearly baseball is a source of pain for Charlie Brown the rest of his life.
Yeah, for sure. This is another one of the earliest ones I would have seen. I think it was called like For the Love of Peanuts, I think was the collection I had that had these in them. Really beautiful drawing. Love it. August 26th. Charlie Brown and Violet are outside. Charlie Brown says, "I'm depressed because I feel you don't love me anymore." Violet answers, "I never did love you, Charlie Brown." Charlie Brown says, "Really? That makes me feel a lot better."
Okay, this is so classic. This is, and that's the marriage thing. I mean, it's pretty obvious.
Oh, boy, if that's true, if that really came out of a conversation, that's pretty heartbreaking.
Yeah, and I do. I actually think we can go too far as to say, well, this is clearly a representation of something that's happening directly in his life.
No,
we have no idea. But, you
know. But we can make things up.
Absolutely. I think
that's why we have a podcast, isn't it?
I think it's about the Red Scare.
Well, that makes me feel a lot better, too. No. Redneck, that's what it's all about, Charlie Brown.
September 3rd, Charlie Brown comes up to Schroeder, who is playing the piano. "Hey, Schroeder, Beethoven is here to see you." "Really?" says Schroeder. "To see me? Gee, I'm so nervous." Schroeder walks to the door and he sees Snoopy imitating Beethoven.
Not only imitating Beethoven, this is like genius cartooning, because Schultz does this. This is the first of Snoopy being an imitator.
Yeah.
Which was a big feature in the late 50s. He'd go around imitating everyone. And it always looked like Snoopy, and it always looked like the person he's imitating. I don't know how he did that.
Although, again, I still think this looks a little more like Larry Fine. But, yes, it is impressive.
I can see that.
September 19th. Lucy comes up to Charlie Brown and says, "My baby brother can sit up." Charlie Brown says, "Really? All by himself?" as the two race off to see Lucy's brother. "Almost. I only had to prop him up a little bit," she says. Charlie Brown sees Lucy's brother for the first time, and there he sits, propped up by a number of 2x4s that Lucy has nailed into the ground.
Oh,
he seems very happy about it.
This is so important, because as you know, Linus is the most complex character in Western literature.
That's true.
And he starts off just a happy little baby. No blanket, nothing.
Recognizable as Linus, but the hair is more drawn as if it's sort of attempting to describe something or a real child might have on top of his head, as opposed to what Linus ends up with, which is just a mass of frayed nerve endings. October 1st. Schroeder is playing the piano. He hums a note while he hits a note on the piano. He excitedly runs to Charlie Brown and says, "Hey, Charlie Brown, I've got perfect pitch." Charlie Brown, reading a book, doesn't even glance up and says, "You mean a perfect pitch. Besides, who cares? The baseball season is over." Schroeder walks away in disgust, saying, "Sometimes I think I should put in for a transfer to a new comic strip."
Ooh, meta, meta. I think this is the first meta strip.
Yeah.
It is not something that happens often outside of the characters looking at the reader and speaking, but it does happen now and again. There are instances of the eyes being referred to as little dots of India ink later. So every once in a while, he goes as so far as to say that this is a comic strip. October 3rd, Charlie Brown. Boy, am I ever depressed. He sees Schroeder walking towards him. He looks sad too. Charlie Brown says, "Somebody else is depressed too, I see." Charlie Brown continues walking, now smiling. That's the only thing that could possibly have cheered me up. So not even an issue of Throttle could have cheered Charlie Brown up at this point. But seeing Schroeder is equally miserable does the trick.
Why is Schroeder miserable? Because Snoopy looks like Beethoven.
Or maybe that's the first appearance of Lucy by his piano off panel.
Well, this is a rare Schroeder not at the piano strip, too.
Yeah, usually you'll see Schroeder either at the piano or later on as catcher of the baseball team and not too many other places.
Yeah, it's just like Shermie is not an option here. He's got to use Schroeder.
October 15th. Violet and Patty are pointing at Charlie Brown and mocking him. Violet says, "We're going to have a party." Patty says, "And we're not going to invite you, Charlie Brown." Charlie Brown says, "I don't care. Ha ha ha. I don't care. Ha ha ha." He runs off, skipping and saying, "I don't care. I don't care. I don't care. Ha ha ha." Then in the last panel, he looks dejected and says, "Rats."
As the leaves fall off the tree. Leaves are always significant in Peanuts.
October 19th. It's a Sunday strip. Snoopy is the life of the party. Schroeder is playing his piano. Everybody's happy watching Snoopy dance. He seems like he's doing some sort of Cossack dance. But then it gets late and everyone has to go home. And Snoopy's upset. He says, "There they go, leaving me alone again. Didn't any of them ever invite me over to spend the night? No. All I'm good for is a few laughs. Rats." Snoopy continues thinking. "They're willing to have me entertain them during the day, but as soon as it starts getting dark, they all go off and leave me. Well, I'll show them. I don't need their company." Then we see Snoopy sitting inside his doghouse with an antenna on the roof and says, "I can always sit at home and watch television."
Is this the first doghouse?
No, but it is the first special doghouse, probably, right?
Right.
I didn't note the first doghouse.
Earlier this year, there was a strip where he had put a little, like a little hotel awning over a walkway in front of his doghouse. So there have been a couple things along these lines, but he's really moved up in the world with the TV and the antenna, I think.
Yeah, we have definitely seen the doghouse. He was on back of Charlie Brown's little wagon at one point and stuff like that. But yeah, Snoopy's doghouse becomes one of the big motifs and big icons of the strip. And this is, as Harold's saying, this is the first time we're seeing it's more than just a regular doghouse. Although, who made it for him, we don't know still, because clearly no one yet really owns Snoopy, even though he has a doghouse with a TV inside.
Mm-hmm. Maybe he inherited some money.
November 5th. Patty is playing with a doll. Charlie Brown approaches holding a new comic strip that he has just drawn and says, "How would you like to read a comic strip I just drew?" Patty is looking at it and Charlie Brown points out what he has drawn. "See, this fellow pulls up in front of the zoo with this truck full of animals and says, 'Got news for you?'" News is spelled G-N-U-S. "Get it?" Charlie Brown walks away, the comic strip over his shoulder, saying, "When it comes right down to it, my type of humor is too subtle for the comic strips."
Mm-hmm. Self-referential. I mean, this is a sequence of strips of him as a cartoonist. We only picked one to talk about. So clearly, he's got ambitions to be as rich and famous as his dad.
I really wonder if he thought this was going to be the kind of thing that could supply a long-term running a source of jokes and entertainment. It would have taken Peanuts in a really strange and I think more insular direction. November 7th, Lucy says to Charlie Brown, "My mother thinks I'm wonderful." Charlie Brown answers, "I imagine she does, Lucy." Lucy says, "She thinks I'll be a cinch to win the title." Charlie Brown asks, "What title?" Lucy says, "Miss Fuss Budget of 1952. Charlie Brown says, "Your mother is a shrewd judge of character, Lucy." Lucy says, "She thinks I'm wonderful."
This is strange because it's not really a gag. You'd think the last line would be a joke of some kind, but it's just a reprise of panel one.
Well, what's the joke is, though, that Fuss Budget is an insult, but Lucy is happy that her mother is saying she'd be the best at it.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand the joke, but also, in my entire life, I've never heard anyone use the word fuss budget.
I was going to ask that. I've never heard it outside of Peanuts either.
Right, but it's totally understandable. No, it's, I mean, that was one of Lucy's major characteristics. She's a fuss budget.
I have to say, I only saw the televised Miss Fuss Budget of 1957, so I don't.
I have I have a few of them on VHS, but. November 16th, Charlie Brown and Lucy are sitting outside. Lucy is dressed in an old-fashioned football helmet, holding a football. Charlie Brown says, "All you have to do is hold the ball, Lucy, then I'll come running up and kick it." Charlie Brown walks away happy. Lucy says, "I don't know if this is such a good idea." Charlie Brown runs towards the football. Lucy pulls it away. Charlie Brown is shocked and lands flat in his back. Whomp. As Charlie Brown sits there recovering from the shock, Lucy says to him, "I was afraid your shoes might be dirty, Charlie Brown. I don't want anyone with dirty shoes kicking my new football." Charlie Brown is irritated and he says to Lucy, "Don't ever do that again. Do you want to kill me? This time, hold it tight. Here we go," he says as he tries for kick number two. The next panel, we just see thump and a question over Lucy's head as Charlie Brown flips head over heels past the football. Lucy's still holding it tight. She says, "I held it real tight, Charlie Brown." Charlie Brown is again flat in his back. "I'm not going to get up. I'm going to lie here for the rest of the day."
Now, is it true that he did one football thing a year, every year?
I mean, I know it. He did it for decades, and I know it was annual. I'm not 100% certain if he does it, you know, the next year or two. But we did have one last year, although it was with Violet. And now we have this one.
Yeah. And Violet was not doing it on purpose. Lucy seems to be. But she didn't seem like really evil on this first one.
No, and she doesn't. She also, you know, he varies up the reasons that she does it over the decades. Some of them are selfish. Some of them are mean. Some of them are accidental.
Sometimes you can't tell at all what her motives are.
Right. Right. And this again goes back to his Crazy Cat influence, where, you know, Crazy Cat was basically about a mouse that hated a cat. The cat loved the mouse. There was a dog that was a police officer who hated the mouse and loved the cat. And the mouse would hit the cat in the head with a brick every single strip. And the art of it and the genius of it was how many different ways you could rearrange those very basic elements so that it was something new in each strip and how deep you could go with that and how high you could go with that. So Schultz is definitely looking for themes and motifs like that. And he has a great one here that goes right through towards the end. I can't wait till we get to the last one. I don't know if you guys know the last strip off the top of your head, but the last, pulling of the way the football is a great ending to a 50-year run of them.
One thing that strikes me in this strip is that Charles Schultz is a great cartoonist and an illustrator, but he doesn't come from the school of, say, animation, where you have the squash and stretch and the line of action and all the things that artists will talk among themselves about in order to get the most fluid or pseudo-logical movement of these rubbery characters. These characters are very compact and they're very solid. And it's only in later times when Schultz starts to play with the shapes a little bit more, particularly with Snoopy. But one of the things that strikes me in this really early strip of something that's going to go on for years and years is the logic of Charlie Brown trying to kick a football. And if that football is there or not there, the idea that if the football's not there, you are going to fly up in the air and land on your back. There's no logic to that, but it's something that he builds into the strip. And it's something that becomes a part of our shared human experience. That's what happens when someone pulls a football away. If it's not there, that's what's going to happen to you physically, which makes no sense. And then the second time in this strip, Lucy's holding the football with her finger, her index finger, supposedly so hard that Charlie Brown not only swings his leg up to kick it, but in that swing, he then goes head over heels over the football, which again makes no real logical physical sense. But Schultz is not at all does not at all have a problem with that, and he's willing to do something that makes cartoon sense in a Schultz world that I don't know any other cartoonist would have thought that these are the outcomes of these physical acts. And yet we buy into it, and it's a part of our culture.
We should have a physicist guest come explain the physics of falling when you're trying to kick a football.
Yes, we'll get a physicist to give us the scoop on all this.
One of the things that I was thinking about as you were talking about that is someone like Dan DiCarlo, actually, it's a different style, but he does things that are sort of similar. He doesn't seem like he comes out of that squash and stretch animation style either. And for some reason, this approach works better for me than something that is too heavily indebted to animation. When it's drawn that way, I become aware of it as a drawing. When it's drawn this way, when it's basically just icons, you know, each panel is its own little composition. There's not a lot of squash and stretch. To me, they become people. I get more invested in them as characters than I do in the drawing. And I have to sort of think about it as a drawn object later.
I think I agree with you in that there were rules that didn't exist in drawing. Animation didn't exist until the 1900s. And the rules of animation over time, it was like best practices of animation where you had cartoonists looking at other cartoonists and saying, how did you get something that's visually where you're drawing a series of drawings together, makes it work so that it reads the best. And it took, you know, it took decades for them to figure this out. But once you figure it out, the downside of everybody learning the best practices is that people can tend to all do the same thing. And they can tend to do the version of, this is the way a character looks when they go flying in the air. This is the way a character looks when they're quizzical. You know, and CalArts was a school where many animators went through their animation program. And so all of a sudden, every time you saw a character looking annoyed or curious, you were seeing the same look. It was like the perfect curious look, which meant it had no personality anymore because every single character looked the same way. And Schultz here is creating his own iconography. And very few people bothered to try to duplicate it because it was so iconoclastic, it was so unique. And I think that's one of the things that really made his work stand out, is he made choices that no other cartoonist could make sense of for the way they drew, or the characters they drew, except for a few very unique situations where they were really, really trying to do Charles Schultz's little kid style.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, each cartoon, the best cartoonists anyway, make their own visual language. And that's why it's magical to step into each different world, because it's, you know, Walt Kelly's Pogo does not look anything like Charles Schultz's Peanuts, and they don't look like anything else either. And that's an amazing thing that comics can do. But you really, you either have to be a just a talented visionary who can pull it out from the get-go, which basically Walt Kelly kind of was, or it's someone who sticks at it and tries different things until they arrive at the things that work, which seems a little bit more what Schultz was doing visually. But I absolutely love it. I think it's such a beautiful drawn strip, and this is where it's really starting to just sing for me.
Yeah, it's great.
December 3rd. Charlie Brown is walking by. He sees Patty and Violet sitting on the curb who are talking. Patty says, "Charlie Brown is an easygoing sort of fellow, isn't he?" Charlie Brown is eavesdropping and he smiles. Violet says, "I'll say he is. Good old Charlie Brown." Patty says, "He seems to get along with everybody." Violet says, "Nobody hates him." Patty says, "Everybody likes him." And Patty says, "What a wishy-washy character." And Charlie Brown is despondent.
That's pretty classic.
This is pure Charles Schultz. Nobody would do this gag except for Charles Schultz. Here you have a character who is being spoken well of for three panels, and yet he's described as wishy-washy because nobody like hates him, everybody likes him. It's just so Charles Schulz. Talk about, you know, iconography of an artist. This is thematically, who else goes to a place like this? Who else would think of someone speaking well of somebody and then turning it into a judgment of that character, which goes into the heart of that character like a knife?
Yeah.
It's just, there's nobody who sees the world the way Schulz does and is able to share it so uniquely and cleanly and clearly with people.
I second that.
You know, the other thing that's interesting is Charlie Brown, in his despair in the last panel, after hearing that he's a wishy-washy character, he doesn't just look sad to himself. He turns to us. He specifically, his body and his head turn to the reader to show that he is sad. So he invites us into that moment.
But are we laughing at him at this point or feeling sorry for him?
I think you're feeling sorry for him.
Well, I think you're feeling sorry, but this is also interesting. Both of you guys have described the strip, which anybody who's familiar with Peanuts, I think, knows what we're talking about when the character is looking at the audience. To me, this shot, this angle is not the character looking at the audience. This is the character showing a very close to looking. It's like in a movie, Oliver Hardy, he looks in the camera. You know he's looking in the camera, he's looking at you. But most of the famous shots in a movie, you don't look into the tomato can. You don't look into the lens of the camera because you're breaking the fourth wall. To me, this little drawing is just off enough that we get to see the full-on expression, but it's not him looking at the audience. Now, there are times like when Snoopy has the little curly Q eye, and it's like you can see the edge of the eye line that Charles Schulz chooses to draw in, and he really is looking at you. There's no question he's looking at you. But to me, this is him having it both ways. He's not really looking into the camera. He's not breaking the fourth wall.
That's funny. To me, this is the one where he most obviously is, because of the turn of the body. I think if he was just despondent, first off, he would still be facing them, or he would at best be facing right 90 degrees. He stops, his body turns away from them, and he's looking directly out. But I understand what you're saying as well. So I think it's certainly enough gray area that you could have it both.
Yeah, because we're all wishy-washy. That's why. You're right, Harold and Jimmy, you're right, even though you said the opposite.
No wonder we really
exactly. December 21st. Charlie Brown is outside. It is a beautiful, clear day. He says, "Here it is, the first day of winter, and there's not a bit of snow on the ground." He leans contemplatively on his tricycle. I can't think of anything more disgusting. Suddenly, a single snowflake falls from the sky. "A snowflake, it's starting to snow." He runs to alert his friends. "Hey, everybody, it's snowing. Get your sleds, get your skis, get your toboggans. Winter is here, it's snowing." Everyone runs to follow after him, Patty and Lucy shouting, "Winter is here, winter is here." The final panel has the whole gang, Schroeder, Patty, Violet, Lucy, Shermy, Snoopy, and Charlie Brown, all dressed in their winter clothes with all their winter accoutrements, looking at the one single snowflake that has landed on the ground.
It's beautiful.
It's a beautifully drawn strip. This is another iconic one from when I was little in that same book.
It's wonderful. Yeah. Just the expressions everyone's got. The only character who has a mouth line is Charlie Brown. It's just a little straight line, and everyone else is just staring intently at that little snowflake. It's a masterpiece of cartooning.
It really is. He at this point is not ever putting a line wrong in the drawing, which is amazing. You know, when you think about the fact that he is now with this Sunday page, he has to do 365 of these things a year. And these Sunday pages there's no shortcuts. You know, he's really using them as an opportunity to flex his drawing muscles, where you get these crowd scenes and these action scenes. it's amazing that it's as consistently well drawn as it is, yeah, with no assistance.
In his third year, well, 2.5 years in. These are the Sundays in particular, are, I think they're all masterpieces. At this point, these are like 10 out of 10s, like consistently.
I think you're right. It's, I never thought about it that way, Michael, until you said it today, but I think you're right. I think that it's crazy how good the Sundays are so fast. This is the first year of having them.
I'd love to know how much time he spent on these strips, particularly the Sundays. It just looks like he's spending more time with more care than in any other time in the 50-year history of the strip. It just, because he really does get into a groove later on that you can tell is a little more loosey-goosey, and yet he's still so brilliant. He, you know, that loose, quick style just pays off over and over. But at this point, he's working. He is really, really working hard. You can tell the lines and the choices and the, you know, that he penciled this thing out. The angles, he's just getting everything right. It's something you can't just make up in your head. At least I don't think you can. He is putting a tremendous amount of work into making these strips. Like you say, Michael, they're little mini masterpieces.
Going back to the lettering thing, the one thing I will say about the early lettering, this is the one part that, I mean, it's flawless. It's great hand lettering. It doesn't have the handwritten feel that his later stuff has, where he's using rounded curves on the M's and W's and stuff like that instead of the points. This feels much more like a kind of a rigorous, almost draftsman-like, you know, lettering like you'd see for an architect or something like that. But it works really well. It still looks beautiful. It's just a little more pedestrian than the other parts of it.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it plays into the detail and the precision that he's going for with so much of what he's drawing. I have some of the strips. He used to do lettering for a Catholic kids magazine called Topics. But what's fascinating to me is in the 1940 and 1950 to earn a living working in comics, other than just doing the teaching he was doing at the art school after a while, he was lettering, apparently it was by the hour, he was paid by the hour. And yet he's lettering a whole 32-page comic, which was coming out every month. And the lettering he's doing for that comic book is surprisingly more idiosyncratic than what we see at the early Peanut strips. And he's working fast. You can tell he's working fast. And since he's being paid by the hour, I'm guessing that means he's a very conscientious person trying to help out this low budget magazine. But he's working closer to some of the style we see, say, in the 60s, late 50s, early 60s, where he's loosened his lettering style and made it very unique and idiosyncratic. Here, what I see is somebody who is going for precision all the way through, and there's the right way to do lettering. And he's trying to get closer to the right way, which takes more time. And that kind of matches to me the lines that you see here, even though, like you were saying, Jim, he's not using a ruler very much at all for any of the elements, including building edges and that sort of thing.
Well, guys, that's 1952 for Peanuts and Charles Schulz. I mean, what are our overall impressions?
Second half of the year, he's totally in there. He's in the slot. I don't think we have anything to worry about except some really horrible things coming up next year. Is that next year? The golf tournament?
Oh, it might be. Yes, yes. There are some weird left turns that I'm sure he was more than happy to excise from everybody's memory until the Fantagraphics books came out. But yeah, it's very exciting stuff coming up.
Yeah, this year it's almost like a switch is turned on January 1st, and there's something that is just richer, deeper, less forced. I think I used the word bland to describe some of the jokes that he had in the previous year. I don't get that feeling at all this year. This year, I feel like he's living a life, and his life experience is rich enough to give him some ideas to put in here, where the relationships feel real. They don't feel forced. They don't feel gaggy or rooted in other comics you might have read 5 or 10 years before. This is all uniquely him and this rich life that he's building for himself. It's a world that I feel happy to live in with him. It's just so beautifully rendered, and he's finding a way to put so much of himself into this strip so quickly. I'm really in awe of what he's doing.
Yeah, and you know, I always think, well, of course you're going to have to put so much of yourself into it because you're doing it on a daily basis, right? Every day you have to have a new gag in the newspaper, 365 days, it goes on and on. And yet you don't see anyone else doing it.
Well, that's it, right? It's like people get into this zone where they're drawing a comic strip in that world, and it's almost like they've detached from that world. And you know, we've all seen strips that in the first year or so, you go back to its origins. Oh, I see why a syndicate editor bought this. I see why this showed such promise. And then in many cases, it's like the artists, in whatever, for whatever reason, they kind of divorce themselves from the heart of the strip. And it's a really sad thing to see. And they're just going through, maybe they had high hopes for it. Maybe they thought it was going to earn them more money. Maybe, who knows? Or maybe they just got tired of the characters and they didn't know where to go with them.
Well, I don't know. I think Walt Kelly would be a distant second from Schultz. And even though his focus was more on current events than digging deep into the characters, but I think he consistently was doing great stuff.
I think Schultz is different in that he's investing himself into the strip. I don't think that Kelly was investing himself in the later strips. I think he was, well, he was certainly putting in the time to make a masterpiece that was, that, you know, and he had help to do it. It wasn't just Schultz by himself. Kelly had letterers and people working underneath him, and he knew how to work as a team. But it becomes less about, I think, the heart of Walt Kelly as he goes along. And that's the thing about Schultz that, you know, we can argue this as we go forward in the years, that Schultz himself is obviously changing and growing as a person all through the 50 years he's living his life. But you know, these early years, a long, long run, it just seems like he finds a way to put one more piece of his soul into this strip, that even like a Walt Kelly, whose work I love and who cared deeply about his politics and tried to kind of share that in ways that were being resisted by newspaper editors and readers. It's a different thing. You know, there's some brilliant stuff in Kelly's work, but it's a little bit arm's distance in some cases. But more so than like somebody who was doing Grin and Bear It, or you know, or a strip like even something like The Far Side, where he got into this kind of strange world zone that he could recreate over and over again. But you know, how much of that is Gary Larson? I don't know.
Right. Well, yeah, and I think you're right. I think Kelly's strip is primarily intellectual. You know, he always strikes me as like your funny, smart uncle that comes and visits. He's always like pulling your leg, and there's wordplay and all that kind of stuff. And frankly, it's a lot easier to read a book of Peanuts these days than it is to read a book of Pogo or a book of Crazy Cat. Well, it's impossible to read a book of Crazy Cat. They weren't designed to be read that way.
Yeah, I never managed to read more than one.
Well, all you can do is read one at a time. That's how they were supposed to be read. I mean, they're not like this, but this.
Yeah,
you could just go page after page after page, and it's a delight. It's constantly a delight. And
yeah, it's so far beyond anything else. Pogo is kind of a vaudeville show in a way.
Yeah, yeah, that's
we're gonna entertain you with banjos and things.
Right,
but we're also gonna take on pretensions, though, that we have a greater insight into the political nature of the country than anybody else. I mean, it's such an interesting mix of what Kelly was doing at different points of his career. And I was just reading in the back, those of you who have the Fantagraphics collections, there is a particularly excellent interview between Charles Schultz, Gary Groth, and I think it's Richard Marshall, that was done in the late 80s, I believe. And it's one of the more definitive interviews later on in his career. And they talk specifically about Walt Kelly and Peanuts. And basically, Schultz I mean, he has almost nothing good to say about Harry Trudeau and Doonesbury. I mean, he is brutally direct that he doesn't think he's professional, this and that. But when it came to Kelly, he said, I used to buy all the books. I used to collect everything. I used to read the comic books when they came out, which would have been around the time that this strip was starting. And in this era, Walt Kelly was still doing comic books. And, you know, Schultz would seek that stuff out. But he said, I'd buy all the paperback books. But over time, I would just look at the pictures and I'd start to read it. And I just had to close it. I couldn't read the Walt Kelly Pogo anymore, the strip reprints, because it was just getting so esoteric for him, the politics and all of that, and he couldn't relate to it.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing about when you're writing about current events and politics is that in pretty short order, they will not be very current events. They don't have legs. And then, you know, not to get into a whole, this is now officially the Pogo and Walt Kelly podcast, but, and then you complicate that with adding a dialect on top of it. I mean, there's a ton of borders of barriers rather for a new reader to enter the world of Pogo. Yeah. And that just doesn't exist with Peanuts.
You're so right. I mean, even just that little ache and pain thing I mentioned, that the unique wording that Violet was using to describe eating too much candy, even that is just such a rarity. It stands out when somebody is using some form of a dialect of a character. Having said that, I'm so imprinted to things that Schultz did, saying rats and good grief, and that that's just life to me. Even though only Schultz said those things, it seems like.
Yeah, but they're simpler. Like Michael said, like we were talking earlier about that fuss budget. Never heard the word before, never saw it anywhere else, but you instantly know what it is.
Yeah,
that's a level of genius. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah, he had a good ear for things that would resonate. I mean, even when he uses things like the term, like not unlike, mm-hmm. that's so Schultz and it's so measured, but I totally imprinted to it as a little kid reading it.
And there's no attempt to mimic slang of the day. Right. I mean, later on, I can think of a couple instances where someone like Peppermint Patty might say groovy or whatever, but they're very, very few and far between.
Yeah, I think he's using mostly the dialect of Albert Payson Turk.
For sure. Guys, I think that is as good a place as any to leave 1952. Before we sign off, do you guys want to put forth your nominees for Strip of the Year?
No.
Yes.
All right, Michael, you go then.
Well, I already mentioned that was my fave. June 22nd, The Comic Book Rack.
The Comic Book Rack. June 22nd, a classic. Harold, how about you?
I would go with June 1st. I just love the flow of the comic timing of the strip where Patty is counseling Charlie Brown on how to keep Snoopy from jumping up on him when he has an ice cream cone. That strip to me is just a joy. It's just this perfect little piece wrapped up in a bow, another Sunday strip. Schultz is just firing on all cylinders there.
Well, I would have picked the comic strip rack as well. However, since Michael already picked that one, I am going to pick 1221, the last one we discussed, and I'm picking it, which is Winter is Here. I'm picking it entirely for the drawing. I love the drawing of all the little kids running. I love it when you get one panel with the whole gang together. Just beautiful drawing. And it's one of my earliest memories of the strip. So that is what I'm going with.
This is the year of the Sundays, boy. He came out of the gate raging with fire.
I was shocked at how strong the Sundays are. Absolutely mind-blowing stuff. All right, so guys, we want you back here next episode. In the meantime, if you want to follow along with this discussion, you can follow us at our social media accounts, either on Twitter or on Instagram. You can get us at Unpack Peanuts. Unpack Peanuts. That's where you can go to vote for your favorite strip too and find out which one of us had the right one. I think eventually we're going to be able to come up with hopefully a top 50, one for each year, what you, the Unpacking Peanuts listeners, have decided is the strip of the year for every year of the strip. This has been Unpacking Peanuts. I'm Jimmy Gownley. For Michael Cohn and Harold Buchholz, we'll see you next time. Thanks.
Unpacking Peanuts is copyright Jimmy Gownley, Michael Cohen, and Harold Buchholz. Produced by Liz Sumner. Music by Michael Cohen. For more from the show, follow Unpack Peanuts on Instagram and Twitter. For more about Jimmy, Michael, and Harold, visit unpackingpeanuts.com. Have a wonderful day, and thanks for listening.
You blockhead!